It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Crisis averted. Ticking bomb dismantled. Armageddon forestalled. Yes, we have officially kicked the can down the road just a bit. Just a little bit. But got something done so that at midnight, the debt fairies didn't come and steal all of our toys. I was waiting. I'll be honest. I thought we'd still be going through this. My mind was in the place of going, hey, we're still ticking down. The clock is ticking. You know, like one of the bad episodes of like that TV show 24, you know, right down to the last second where they wait till 3, 2, click. We saved everyone. I was kind of waiting for that because this is what we've become as a country. This is, I guess, how we're going to run this lemonade stand in the most ridiculous backwards way possible so that we keep people, keep them guessing. Also, we can have someone to score some cheap political points, which, you know, I'll tell you, I think the Republican Party's getting a little older. You know, if this were the Obama years, we'd still be hanging around. I think now what happened, and this is how I think what happened, I think the Republicans were like, soup's getting cold. You know, let's get this done. We're going to do it anyway. Let's do it now so we can still have soup while it's hot. Kind of the only thing I can come up with. And this brings me to the point of why do we go through this ridiculous exercise? Why is this arcane construct even there? It doesn't restrict us from spending. It has not restricted us. All it's done is it's created these moments where someone, whoa, I see a political advantage. Let's score some points. And Democrats always lose. And look, this is where Ted Cruz generally would have been right about today. That Democrats would have surrendered, and they did, on a certain number of things. This isn't doing away with the debt ceiling. This is just kicking it down the can another couple of weeks so that Republicans can continue to use this to dangle over their head to go, see, we're willing to burn the house down. Are you? Because they are. They're willing to torch the place. If they're not in charge, if they don't get their way, if it's not spending on things that they want, you know, feeding billionaires, because we've got a bunch of wayward billionaires and they need a little extra money. Because it's interesting, billionaires always seem to need more money. They always need more deregulation, more money, lax environmental regulations, cheap labor, because they need more money. And, you know, you working people, you just need to tighten the belt a little bit. Just a little bit more. A little bit more. A little more sacrifice. If you do a little bit more, and the company makes a little bit more money, maybe we get our CEO to the next level. Because evidently that's what matters. And I look at this tweet from Kyrsten Sinema. And, you know, Senator Dipsy Doo from Arizona, she tweeted out, this is a while ago. Now, look, this could have quite possibly been a different Kyrsten Sinema. This could have been the one the aliens didn't take, or they did. Who knows? She tweeted out on the May 26th of 2011. This is a decade ago. It's a while ago, but same senator. She tweeted at a couple of different people saying, asking big corporations and the rich to pay their fair share is common sense, not class warfare. And you go, in this last decade there, Dipsy Doo, how'd you get to, we're not going to raise the minimum wage. No, we can't pass an infrastructure bill that's going to tax the wealthy. No, we can't make drug companies negotiate for the prices of their drugs. No, we can't do any of that. What in that decade? Oh, what? Because I remember when Sinema came on the scene. She was like the AOC of the time, kind of a cool, hip, bisexual. You know, she was it. She was the in girl. And now, the one possibly going to hold up progress, going to stall this infrastructure bill that is wildly popular. And this is where I go. This is wildly popular. There's nothing controversial when you talk to average, everyday working people. Now, CEOs, not happy. The very wealthy, certainly not happy. Corporate America, oh my goodness, not happy. And conservatives, not happy, because what this is kind of a reset of 40 years of bad conservative economic policies. This is actually, wait for it, here it comes. This is actually about helping people. I know the party of life. They don't care about you unless you're in utero. As soon as you pop out, you're on your own, brother. And their policies have shown that. Democrats are going, no, maybe we should get, you know, kids early education. Maybe we should get people health care so that, you know, that when they're born, they're cared for. Maybe we should do something around higher education. Maybe we should make sure kids don't go to bed hungry. We should do something about childhood poverty. We should do something about all this stuff. And maybe when they get older, you know, when they become grandparents, maybe they can get a pair of choppers and, you know, some goggles so they don't walk into the walls, you know, and maybe, you know, something for the ears so you're not going what all the time. But no. Cannot do, because that would mean we'd have to tax the very wealthy. And it's insane to me that we're in this moment. But yeah, this is where we are. We've, like I said, averted the shutdown. Get ready for it. It's going to come back. It'll boomerang back. We'll do this again. It wasn't as big a party as I was hoping for. I had some streamers, and I actually had some things planned. They kind of ruined it on me. Now the other part of this, Joe Manchin. Joe has said that he has now tagged a number to what he will accept in the Build Back Better infrastructure part of the plan. He says, bottom line, the most he's going to go for, $1.5 trillion. He said, this is the part that gets me. He said, the rest of it, we should take to the ballot box. And you go, hey, ding dong. That's what last November was about. That was about people saying, yes, we want to get rid of the former guy. Yes, we want to deal with the pandemic. But yes, 8 million more people voted for Biden. Running on the plan of, yes, we need to expand certain social safety net programs. We need to deal with climate change. We've got problems upon problems that need to be addressed. You can't just throw a temper tantrum and say the other guy wouldn't do it. Not going to work anymore. Things have to get done. So the reality is, last November was when we voted on this stuff. And this is seeming an awful lot like deja vu. Because if you go back to the Obamacare fight, this is the same kind of rhetoric, different characters. You know, we had Trader Joe and Max Backdoor Us back then. They were the ones who gutted the Affordable Care Act in ways that have created the problems we have now. But it's always one or two conservative Democrats who do this. And, you know, Republicans don't really have that problem because they've purged. They've gone from, you know, a party that, you know, sometimes had to now a little off the rails. I fear someone like Manchin. I question the motives. I fear he's setting the party up for a massive disappointment. Because we're waiting to see if the vote's going to happen on the bipartisan plan. And if it does happen without the Build Back Better plan, there's part of me that goes, you know, if I'm a Republican congressman and Pelosi puts it up for a vote and you have AOC and the progressives going, we're not voting for this unless we get the other one. If I'm a Republican, I'm voting for it. I'm voting for the bipartisan bill that everybody wants. But Republicans don't want to give the Democrats a win. So I'm going to cause that chaos. I'm going to vote and I'm going to do that. And here's the problem. Then you don't get the Build Back Better plan, which is the investment that we really, really need. Now, we really need the hard stuff. We need the roads and the bridges and then the broadband. We need all that desperately. We need upgrades. Well, we've needed them for decades. In fact, the American Society of Civil Engineers says the $1.2 trillion that they're talking about is only about, well, a quarter of what we actually need. But never mind what we actually need. This is the best we're going to get. So I say we take it, we get what we can, and we move forward. But if we just get the hard infrastructure bill, And this is what Republicans, I think, are playing for. Because they'll be able to go back home and say, look, we paved your roads. We did all that. But we didn't get, they didn't do that other stuff for those people. And of course, they're going to use the divisions that have gotten got them to the dance. It's what they do. There's nothing surprising about that. They're gonna blow the dog whistle or the dog just to make sure that nothing gets done. And this is the weird little world that we're in right now. So now you've got them saying, well, but you should compromise. Democrats should compromise. And look, they did. The original Build Back Better plan was like $6 trillion. They compromised down to 3.5. And now you've got Manchin going, no, we need to compromise even further, more. And the thing is in the Build Back Better plan, there are really popular things in there. The idea of early childhood education. I know a lot of people were like, look, society has changed. We need to get kids into school earlier for a whole plethora of reasons. But we need to get that formal education moving. Very popular on the other end of getting, you know, free community college to make sure that, look, you know, 50 years ago, you could get through, you could get by with an eighth grade education. I look at my grandparents' generation. My grandfather didn't make it out of the eighth grade. Yet he was probably one of the smartest people I know in dealing with people and was able to lead a very successful life, a solidly middle-class existence. Raised his kids, bought a house, you know, lived and died in the house that he was the king of. My grandmother as well. You can't do that anymore. Eighth grade ain't going to cut it no more. You've got to get that next bit of education. And look, 100 years ago, eighth grade was enough. And then they said, no, you got to go to high school. Now I'm saying you got to get that extra 2 years. You've got to get that technical training, that vocational training, or that college certificate. You've got to get something. And it's got to be part of regular education for everyone else, not people who can afford it, not people who are willing to take on massive debt. This is society now, and it's enormously popular. All of these things, when you strip away the politics, wildly popular. Family medical leave, wildly popular. Expanding Medicare, drop it down to 60. I was just talking about this today. If they were to drop Medicare age down to 55, which there has been some talk of 55 or 60. Do you know how many people my age would be going, time to retire? And then going on to doing something, I don't know, something like that they want to do. They would have the freedom to do other things, be able to follow a passion, make a living doing anything else other than tied to a job that technically they're taking from a young person who needs that job to start their lives and be able to attain what that person had. But we won't do it because, well, I don't know why. It's insane that we tie our health to an employer. And look, I know tons of people, myself included, stay at a job that they're really not fond of anymore. They're ready to move on. But it's the healthcare benefits. Can't find them anywhere else. Got to make sure that the kids have coverage. Got to make sure that your spouse has coverage. Got to make sure you have coverage. And it's got to be good stuff. It can't be that crap that they're trying to pass off as insurance that, it's 20% code payments, 20% deductible, co-insurance. It's crazy. But we're just in this spot where we can't seem to get anything done. And it comes back to the people that we continue to put into these offices. And I look at someone like Sinema, who, like I said, 10 years ago was a progressive champion. What happened in those 10 years? Now, the story has been banging around that she got, $750,000 from Big Pharma, which is why she tanked the negotiations for negotiating with Medicare. I'm not saying she did or she didn't. I'm not saying that's the reason. Seems kind of, I don't know, coincidental? Or is it just the nature of the beast? Now, I had a friend who was a congressman years ago, congressman from Illinois, good union guy, liked him a lot. He said, no one's ever bought my vote. No one ever bought my vote. You know, no one has, you know, here's $20,000, vote this way. He goes, that isn't how it happens. He said, you know what? Every day I got to pick up a phone. Every day I got to walk across the street. I got to pick up a phone. And I got to make 4 hours of phone calls to raise money for an election 2 years from now. I got to keep begging for money. And every time I go, hey, I need campaign money. They go, okay, well, hold on a second. I want to talk to you about something. And he said, you know, you spend enough time talking with people about their concerns and their issues. You know, the people who have the money. You kind of start going, you start identifying with some of the things that they're saying. Yeah, that might not be a bad idea. And they have think tanks who, you know, write out talking points on how to lobby your congressman before you give them a donation for their campaign. You know, the lifeline of their existence. And he said, look, you know, you hear this all day long and it can sway you. So I'm trying to give Kyrsten Sinema the benefit of the doubt that maybe this is just what it is. It's the cesspool that's infected her thinking. But when someone says, you know, a decade ago, you know, hey, asking the wealthy to pay their fair share is common sense, not class warfare. And yet we can't seem to get her on board to say, no, you're right. We should be taxing the wealthy. They should be paying their fair share. There should be something there. It seems kind of curious. It just seems very, very odd to me that we can't get this done. So as I said, there's a lot of blame to go around here. Manchin and Sinema. That's basically it. Because if the Democrats were really a party that wanted to lead, if they were really a serious party, you would get them on board. I guarantee you, as much as I disliked Tom DeLay, I guarantee you the hammer would have got his people in line, would have had people in line already and not allowed the circus that Manchin has gotten us. And this idea of compromise, you know what compromise gets you in this moment? Defeat in the next election. It happened to Clinton. It happened to Obama. It's going to happen again to Biden if they allow this to happen. So at some point, Biden's got to step forward and he's got to put some pressure on. And I know there have been a lot of backroom phone calls and meetings and stuff like that. This has got to get done because we desperately need the investment. We desperately need it for the future, not just for us, but also for our kids. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Max Burns is going to be here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2012. That was the day the Chicago Teachers Union walked off the job for the first time in 25 years. The historic week-long strike resonated nationwide among trade unionists and served to reinvigorate the labor movement. Certainly, higher wages and better benefits were among the teachers' demands. The city's mayor, Rahm Emanuel, had canceled the union's wage increase, laid off close to 1,000 teachers, and went on the attack against seniority rights and working conditions. The strike enjoyed wide public support among parents and the public. Teachers emphasized broader educational problems they faced, namely the attacks fueled by corporate privatization. They wanted a return to more traditional forms of education rather than simply preparing students for endless rounds of testing. They wanted more art, music, and gym classes. And they demanded stable funding for social support services for the most vulnerable at-risk students. Union teachers understood that the Board of Education was using standardized testing to get rid of teachers and schools in order to privatize education, all in the name of turning around failing schools and helping the kids. Though the contract was less than perfect, it showed the power working people have to hold the line against continued assaults on their standards of living, especially in the public sector. The CTU was able to beat back attempts at merit pay and increased use of student test scores in teacher evaluations. They won first-time recall rights, supply reimbursements, and liberal arts classes. There were concessions, however, made on seniority rights, pay for laid-off teachers, and longer workdays. But the CTU demonstrated that strikes can win in a period of extended anti-union onslaughts.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I said, crisis averted, Armageddon forestalled, the end of the world is not coming. Because look, I honestly was surprised that they didn't drag this out a little bit longer. I don't know what was going on this evening. Maybe there was, you know, some congressional softball game they wanted to get to. I don't know, but somehow they came to kicking the can down the road a little bit earlier and here to share some thoughts on, well, what this means and, kind of prime us for the next time, because it's only a couple weeks away. I've asked our good friend Max Burns to come talk with us. Max is a columnist and a Democratic strategist. He does his work over at the Daily Beast. Max, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's get right into the shutdown that didn't happen. Surprised they got it done as early as they did?
I am. We've sort of averted one bullet out of what is essentially a machine gun today of things that are coming up against the line. This was very pressing. The government was going to shut down tomorrow if this hadn't passed. And then we still have to deal with a potential default in October. But for now, the government's open through December. There's a deal everyone agrees with. It seemed to come out of thin air, but I think we can be glad we at least have one victory here.
I mean, the Republicans were so dug in. Is it that, you know, when they looked around, they realized that the rest of us really weren't on their side, and probably, you know, the people who are on their side weren't either?
If I had to guess, knowing how the GOP operates in the Senate, as they got some polling back that was much more devastating than I think they anticipated, Republicans generally always operate under the belief that the party in power is blamed for a government shutdown. I don't think that logic has held as well here. It was pretty clear from the beginning. I think McConnell basically said, do it yourself too early and sort of gave away his hand at the beginning. And with that sort of building in the press, they just didn't have any room to maneuver. I mean, they were going to take the heat for this.
Yeah, you know, the thing is you had Ted Cruz running around saying, you know, the Democrats, they're going to surrender. The Democrats are going to surrender because that's what they do. And look, that's what Democrats generally do. And I'll tell you, I'm a little surprised they didn't.
We're busy maybe surrendering on infrastructure to surrender on this. We have to surrender on things one at a time, I think, is what Ted Cruz doesn't understand. I think this is a great thing. Like, we can be happy with this. It keeps the government open at a time when we need it to be open.
Yeah, I'm not happy about this. This should not be an issue. This isn't something we should have spent any time on. This should have never happened. This is an arcane construct that should be done away with. We shouldn't be having these ticking bombs. This is no way to run a lemonade stand, let alone the most powerful country on earth.
Right? It's not a great example of democracy at work. And my worry is, in addition to sort of the political domestic problems this creates, where people just don't trust government to get things done, foreign governments like China use this deadlock as an example of how democracy has failed.
Right.
And how their method of government that they push to countries in Africa and Latin America is superior because it doesn't have these crises. So we have to think internationally as well as domestically on these crises in the future.
So let's talk surrender, because originally the Build Back Better plan was, as I remember, the price tag was $6 trillion they wanted to get out, had a lot of things in it. They said, no, let's pare that back because we need to compromise. They pared it back to $3.5 trillion. Now you got Joe Manchin, who has staked the flag in the ground saying, the top, the most I'm willing to go, $1.5 trillion. Do you think this moves?
Right now, it's not clear that anything is moving. I've been following this through the day. There's no sign of it ending yet. We just heard from sources on the Hill that there will likely be an infrastructure vote around 10 o'clock tonight. So it seems like Pelosi, who is not known for calling votes that she will lose, thinks she has the numbers, but I've run the numbers every way I know how, favorable to her and not, and I just can't see how she has them.
Yeah, I don't see how she has the numbers unless, and this is one of those things I've been pitching for a while, unless there are a number of Republicans who are going to come forward and you know, throw the votes just for one, we need the infrastructure bill, but for two, yep, major chaos in the Democratic Party. If this passes, if the bipartisan bill passes and the Build Back Better portion doesn't, this is a nightmare for Democrats in 2022.
It is. And I'm skeptical about Pelosi having secret Republicans, because I just don't, from everything we know of Kevin McCarthy, is he going to say, wow, Democrats are really in trouble, let's help them, let's get them out of this jam? He's content to let them fight this out.
Yeah. But,
sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm looking at this from the man, if I'm him, I'm thinking of how can I cause the most chaos in their party while being able to go back to my district and saying, hey, look, we got something to bring home. I brought the bacon home. We didn't get all that other crap that they were trying to get. We got the bread and butter, and here it is. So they get to take credit for it, and they get to throw massive chaos in the Democratic side. I think that's a win for them, and I can't believe we're in this position.
Yeah, I agree with your political logic here. There's only one problem for the Republicans, is that Donald Trump does not want them to do that. And they will follow whatever Donald Trump wants, regardless of whether it's bad for them.
Yeah.
And this challenge, though, with Pelosi, as someone I was speaking to on the Hill said to me, if she had the votes, we'd have had this vote 6 hours ago. The fact that this is going so late tells me that there's something going on with Manchin, Sinema, and the White House, which at this point is the only way you're going to get anything.
Yeah. So how much of this is Joe Biden's fault? I mean, there are some people who are saying he didn't put enough pressure. Some people, he wasn't public enough. You're going to get a whole bunch of, you know, back and forth. How much of this is his fault?
You do have to put some blame on Joe Biden. The buck stops with the president. He put forward this agenda. He made it clear it was important to him, but then hasn't really pushed until this last few weeks in a very concerted way, Manchin and Sinema. They've been up to the White House frequently over the last couple of weeks. But there were months here where the Senate was hashing this out, where presidential leadership would have been welcome, where people were asking for presidential leadership on this. But Biden has said he wanted to let the Senate decide for themselves. And this is one of the problems. You need a leader to drive these things.
So how much of this do you think then is, you know, Biden was in the Senate forever. I mean, he's a guy who's been around. How much of this is just him leaning back on his relationships with those senators and figuring, you know, hey, look, we've been here, we've been doing this together. I know you guys. This is important. We need to move this through. And it was just, hey, we assumed that we're all going to get on board, that finally Democrats were moving in the right direction. Because look, this stuff is popular. People want this. People need this. And I can't believe we're where we are.
That's the craziest part to me, is there was just a Charleston Gazette in West Virginia paper came out showing that a majority of West Virginians support $3.5 trillion is the number in West Virginia, even a majority of Republicans. But Joe Biden has put so much stock in the campaign and in his presidency on, I know how the Senate works, I can backslap. And that might be true for some people. That might even be true for his relationship with McConnell. But the Senate has changed drastically since 2008. There are senators in there who do not ascribe to this collegial, let's work together viewpoint anymore, and haven't for a decade. His experience is unfortunately somewhat out of date.
No, that's an excellent point. And you would think, you know, because it seems to me we're reliving 2009, 2010 again. This seems like deja vu all over again when talking about the Affordable Care Act. Only different players. I mean, Manchin wasn't front and center. It was Trader Joe Lieberman, and it wasn't Kyrsten Sinema. It was, you know, Max Backdoras. I mean, we've had our characters in the past, but it seems like we're getting to the same place where we have a great idea and we end up with a half measure.
I had forgotten about Joe Lieberman after all these years. Thank you for bringing that back into my nightmares. No, it is. And we compromised in 2010 on ACA, and then were wiped out in the midterms. This is not something that's new. Every time Democrats have had this opportunity to pass really progressive, really ambitious legislation that voters said they want, we've erred on the side of caution, And voters have said, if you're not going to govern like Democrats, why do we keep electing Democrats? And that is a question that the party's going to have to answer after tonight.
Yeah, isn't that the old Harry Truman quote? You know, if you give a voter a choice between a Republican and a Democrat that acts like a Republican, they're going to vote for the real thing every time.
Absolutely. And this is a message we keep getting hit with and yet keep having to remind the party establishment that the voters have been clear about what they want. They flipped Georgia of all places because the passion for this agenda was so high. So to now say we're not sure we're going to do it is suicide. I don't understand it at all.
Yeah, it's crazy. And this idea of a strategic pause or my other favorite one is, you know, we'll go to 1.5 trillion and then, you know, we'll go back to the ballot box. Isn't that what November was?
Exactly. I mean, we went back to the ballot box in 2020 with the Build Back Better agenda. We rolled it out all of December and then voted in January in Georgia and won two seats in a red state. The Build Back Better agenda has been vetted by 81 million people. That's why Democrats control Washington. So if they don't act on it, I mean, that's their own unforced error.
Yeah, it's something that most certainly needs to be done. But, you know, here's the thing. We're in this weird world, Max, where, you know, what you and I want, what the average working stiff in this country wants, never seems to get addressed. It's all about the moneyed interest. And I said a minute ago that, you know, Kyrsten Sinema a decade ago tweeted out that, you know, raising taxes on the wealthy was common sense. It wasn't class warfare. And I'm going, you know, where is that Kyrsten Sinema? Where was that person who for a decade ago was saying we need to do all these things and voted in those ways to where now when you've had the chance to make it actually matter, somehow she's, I don't know.
And it's important to note in this that progressives on this side, the Progressive Caucus, Pramila Jayapal, are the ones fighting to preserve Biden's agenda in full. That these are the ones who are fighting to govern like Democrats. And they're actually holding the line. I'm hearing just a few minutes ago, the Progressive Caucus is going to whip votes against this infrastructure bill tonight. So it certainly seems like we're going to see a showdown on the floor that could have huge consequences.
Absolutely. And this was my concern from the beginning. So we're on the same page. From the beginning, I said, I don't think we're getting anything. I think at the end of the year, we're going to be looking at each other going, how do we get nothing? And this is how we get nothing. If Republicans don't come and save the bipartisan thing just to cause chaos, I fear we could end up with nothing.
Yeah, and that's a very real fear. It's sort of an apocalyptic scenario for Biden to end the year facing a potential government default with both of his signature first-year bills going down in flames because of his own party. And that kind of weakness will be capitalized on by the GOP and will be torn to shreds for that. So the time for action is now. And I hope that that Manchin and Sinema see the light here in the next hour or so, because the clock is ticking.
Yeah. And because here's the question then also, you know, come next year, what do you then go to the voters with? I mean, obviously, I think Biden has done a very good job on the pandemic, I think as best as he could possibly do, given the position of the country. I think the stimulus, the rescue plan that they got through was extremely helpful. It did what it was supposed to do. But if you don't get that next thing that's going to make people's lives that much better, I don't know how you, especially young people, I don't know how you motivate those 80-some million people who came out in 2020 to come out in 2022.
Yeah, and if they do, they're certainly not voting for these centrist Democrats who have kneecapped this process at every turn. I mean, the progressive candidates on this issue are pushing an issue that has almost 70% national support, the Build Back Better plan. They are desperately trying to get Democrats to take this win, this low-hanging fruit, and the fight that's being put up to prevent that from happening is concerning, extremely concerning.
Yeah, so what do you say to the message? Because I get this a lot. You know, this is why we need to expand the majorities. This is why we need to, and XYZ, and this is every political cycle. We couldn't get something done because, well, we didn't have enough. So we keep going through this perpetual fight of we need more, and we never seem to get there. So are you making the argument that, you know, hey, next year we need to buck up and vote for Democrats because maybe this time we're going to get it?
I mean, at the moment, I can't sell that because I don't believe it. I think saying, you know, we need to keep delivering for the American people, but we need more Democrats in the Senate, only works if you actually deliver something. Right now, they're saying we control Washington, but we don't control Washington enough, which is simply not a message most voters are going to understand or quite honestly find credible. They'll say you have power. Republicans used it when they had it. What was your problem? And Democrats don't have an answer for that right now.
Yeah, I said earlier that, you know, I don't think Tom DeLay would have allowed this to happen. I think the hammer would have gotten people in line, and this would have been a done deal if this were a Republican priority. And this isn't a shot on Nancy Pelosi. It's a shot on the entire Democratic Party.
Yeah. And I will say, if Pelosi somehow does have the votes and pulls this out, she will have absolutely earned every bit of her reputation as a master legislator. It will truly be something I don't think anyone expects.
No, I'm right there with you. I think it's something that we most certainly need to get through. And I will give her the credit that she deserves if we muster this through. But that's a pretty big if. So in looking at this, you know, what are you expecting tomorrow morning to bring us?
I don't even know what tonight is going to bring us, Rick. I think depending on how this goes, there's really three options. The vote happens and it fails, the vote happens and it passes, or they pull the vote. And only one of those is really a victory for Pelosi, which is passage. Progressives here have a lot of opportunity to really take this as a victory and show Americans that they don't just do comms, they can also handle the legislative process and twist arms where they need. So I think we'll see a progressive party that is much more confident in themselves within the Democrats going forward.
Yeah, but here again, you know, like you said, if they flex that muscle, we could end up with nothing. And then do they become the target of the ire, or is it the Pelosi side? Because here's my fear. My fear is each of the splinters in the Democratic Party, they become the focus of the ire, and the Republicans who caused this walk away scot-free.
So I think for one of the rare times I'll say this, but the progressives actually seem to be getting a pretty good news cycle because I think the polling is so clear.
Right.
I think the media is seeing that the obstruction on Manchin is well outside the mainstream. It certainly doesn't represent the party. So he can't claim to be defending Democratic values. But so far what I've seen is that progressives have received praise for this, and that's something that they're not used to, and it will be interesting to see how they use that capital.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. But Max, I appreciate the time, the work that you do. Keep it up. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Anytime. Thanks.
Good stuff, our good friend Max Burns. Make sure you check out his work over at the Daily Beast. We'll get links out on how you can check that out. We're going to find out. I'm still hopeful. I'm hopeful that the argument that Nancy Pelosi is the master vote counter and can manipulate this stuff through, I'm hoping. We'll see. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1919. That was the day that began the Elaine Massacre. The massacre took place in Arkansas, where more than 100 black farmers and sharecroppers were gunned down for daring to organize their labor. The year before, a black farmer by the name of Robert L. Hill had founded the Progressive Farmers and Household Union of America. Union members pooled their money to purchase land. They also hired a lawyer to sue planters who did not give black tenant cotton farmers their fair share of the profits. The group grew in membership in the Arkansas Delta region, including near the town of Elaine in Phillips County. But white landowners would not allow this challenge to their power. Armed white militias came to a church where the union was holding a meeting. The black attendees were also armed. Gunfire broke out. In response, white posses and federal troops unleashed a wave of terror across Phillips County. Hundreds of black residents were arrested. At least 100 black Arkansans were killed. Some estimates of those murdered is considerably higher.
5 white people also died. 122 black men and women were charged with murder. 12 were given the death sentence. No white vigilante, however, was ever charged. The convicted African Americans appealed their cases. One appeal for 6 of the defendants went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, where it was overturned in a landmark ruling. The year of 1919 was one of the deadliest years of violence against African Americans in U.S. history. Civil rights activist James Weldon Johnson called those bloody months the Red Summer. 26 race riots left thousands of African Americans homeless and hundreds dead from Chicago to Washington, D.C. to Omaha.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So first you had Justice Amy Coney Barrett saying that the Supreme Court is not comprised of a bunch of partisan hacks. Now today you got Justice Alito saying that the High Court is not a dangerous cabal. And I got to tell you, when you have to defend on those lines, it kind of makes you wonder, are they a bunch of partisan hacks? Is it a dangerous cabal? And look, we're entering into the next couple of weeks, going to be the culture wars getting into the courts. And we're going to find out exactly, where they stand on those culture war issues. And here to share some thoughts on what we can expect coming out of this court in the next term, I've asked Elliot Mintzberg to come talk with us. Elliot's a senior fellow over at the People for the American Way. Elliot, thanks for taking time for us.
Pleasure to do it, Rick.
So here we are, the former guy's gone. All of those hot button culture war issues have now made it through the lower courts and going to be sitting on the Roberts Court's lap. Abortion, religion, all of those things. How bad is this term going to be?
It could be a disaster for Americans and their rights. This will be the first time in about 30 years that Ruth Bader Ginsburg has not sat on the Supreme Court, replaced as she is by Amy Coney Barrett, starting this term, making those very defensive comments that you pointed out. And unfortunately, she's already shown that there's good reason for concern about the dangerous cabal that now as many as 6 justices of the Supreme Court can constitute that can take away rights with respect to abortion care, common sense gun safety, and religious freedom, among just a few.
And today, the court, I guess, agreed to hear this challenge in Boston, because the way I'm getting this, the city of Boston rejected a group's demand to raise a Christian flag over the city hall, and they said, no, we've got to raise the American flag and whatever. Can we now? I guess we're going to start it. If this goes through, we're going to see religious flags all over the place?
Well, unfortunately, what we've seen from this court, and we'll have to see if they're willing to go this far, is extreme deference to religious extremists, even to the extent of sometimes compromising COVID-19 safety rules, as we saw last term. And that case, plus the case where where religious extremists are claiming that a state must pay, not can pay, but must pay, for religious education in schools are examples that could seriously harm the religious freedom of most of us.
Yeah, I mean, it's really quite remarkable. But I look at this flag issue, and I brought this up to someone today, and they're like, what's the big deal? It's just a flag. So the question is, what is the big deal if we allow a religious group to fly their flag for a couple of days?
Well, it's not them flying their flag over their headquarters. It's essentially forcing the city of Boston to itself fly the flag right alongside the state flag and the United States flag, clearly, symbolically endorsing, having the government endorse their very clearly religious message, something that's never been permitted before by the Supreme Court or any other court. The First Circuit Court of Appeals unanimously rejected that idea. But that's what they're trying to do. They are trying, are the religious extremists, to co-opt government in their favor in a way that hurts the religious freedom of everybody else besides them.
So the fact that you're saying the lower court unanimously rejected this, so that tells me there are four justices that, because I guess you have to have four justices to take a court case, there are four of them that, that'll probably vote for this. So one more, this could be the law of the land? We could be seeing religious flags flying over our capitals?
It's quite possible. I mean, this doesn't necessarily apply to every single situation, but there are many situations where government, for example, will endorse the Boy Scouts or will endorse other recognized private interests, which if they do that from now on, they would have to endorse also religious extremist points of view, along with everything else.
Yeah. So, because my friend's like, well, what's the big deal? I go, well, if it's your religion, probably not a big deal in your mind. But what if it's a religion you don't agree with?
That's exactly correct. The whole idea of religious freedom in our country is that we are each free to practice our religion, but not to have the government push somebody else's religion. Or as Ruth Bader Ginsburg once put it, your right to swing your fist stops at the other guy's nose. When you push your religious freedom to harm somebody else, the Constitution is supposed to stop that from happening. That's been the case. We've seen some exceptions. These two cases this year on the flag and on the required funding of religious education could really take us back to before the early 1960s, when the Supreme Court said that government couldn't force students to say a Christian prayer in schools.
Yeah, I mean, we're heading into an interesting moment. I got to tell you, I'm not feeling warm and fuzzy given the fact that this court has a history of overturning long decided law. You know, I look at the Janus decision. You know, just decided out of whole cloth. It doesn't give me great faith.
It shouldn't. I mean, you know, you see already what they did in the area of abortion care to allow the terrible Texas law to take effect. Now they're being asked explicitly to say that states can prohibit abortions long before viability, clearly threatening to eliminate the constitutional right to reproductive freedom that was protected almost 50 years ago in Roe versus Wade.
Now, there seem to be a lot of cases on the abortion issue. You got the one in Mississippi. You got one in Texas. I guess there's another one from attorneys generals who I guess have filed. There's a bunch of this that seem to have made their way into this, all from different angles and, you know,
yep,
different schemes. But they're all going for the same thing, which is to limit my daughter's ability to oversee what happens to her future.
Absolutely correct. To allow restrictive governments to do what they will on this, but at the same time, here's one of the interesting ironies, saying that even in the name of saving people's lives, government can't go forward with common sense gun safety regulations. That even Justice Scalia, when he reinvigorated the Second Amendment some time ago, said ought to be safe. But Amy Coney Barrett already made clear on the Seventh Circuit that she thinks a lot of those laws ought to go. And the third major area the courts accepted this year in the area of gun violence and gun safety could very well eliminate an important gun safety regulation in New York that says that if you want to carry a gun walking up and down the street, a concealed gun, you have to have a good reason for it. That's all it says. And the NRA and their advocates want to eliminate that.
Yeah, well, they want those to be issued at birth. I mean, you know, that's the, you know, we want to be strapping on six-year-olds as they're going to kindergarten.
Well, and the enormous contradiction is clear. On the one hand, let the states do what they want to restrict abortion care. On the other hand, don't let them do anything to save lives with gun safety rules.
Yeah, but let me ask you about the abortion question, because I do believe that they're going to find a way to make it much more difficult, much more restrictive, without an outright ban. Or you're the expert here, but I don't think they're going to go all the way this time. I think that comes down the road, because, look, I think the Republicans need it as an issue to keep people blinded by reality and, you know, emptying their pockets into the campaign coffers. But what, let's say they do it all. It's now unconstitutional. It's now thrown out. They've overturned it. What does that look like then? What happens after, the day after?
Well, we've seen, unfortunately, a preview of that in Texas, where the law that was allowed to take effect there effectively closed abortion clinics all through the state. And as a result of that, particularly poor women have been forced to have unwanted births. Some people have tried to go out of state to do what they can do. Back alley abortions could be literally around the corner again, all in the name of, if not overturning in name, as you suggest, effectively eviscerating the protections of decisions like Roe versus Wade and Casey.
And you know who will continue to get safe abortions? Wealthy women. Yeah, the wealthy politicians who push this through, their daughters and their wives, they'll get what they need. It's poor people who are going to suffer, and that's my problem with a lot of this stuff. It seems very punitive and very pointed at poor people.
Absolutely right. Poor people, minorities, people who aren't in with some of the, unfortunately, predominant forces in so many of our state and local governments around the country.
Yeah, I mean, I look at this Texas law that is especially interesting and creative. I got to give them credit. This was a new little wrinkle, this whole bounty hunter thing. We could turn this into a reality game show.
Oh, absolutely right. And if the Supreme Court doesn't go as far as right-wing extremists want them to, in terms of gun safety, the same thing could happen with guns. You set up a law that would allow people to sue anybody that tries to stop them, even in the name of gun safety and saving lives, from total unfettered access to the most deadly weapons.
Yeah, it's we're heading into very bizarre territory. And I don't even know where this leads us, but I have nothing but fear and dread of this court, given their history. And it's not just women's rights. It's just not guns. It's also people with disabilities who are on the chopping block, because there are a number of cases I see that have made their way through that will harm the disability community. I'm curious your thoughts on some of what that could look like.
Now, those are extremely dangerous cases. There's one in particular where the court's being asked to rule that the only way you can claim discrimination based on disability is if you can prove intent to discriminate on the basis of disability, that you can't do what you could do with all other civil rights laws, including fair employment laws, and argue that if a state or in this case a drugstore like CVS has a policy that has the effect of seriously harming people with disabilities, they can't even get into the courthouse door unless they can prove it was intended to harm them because of their disability, an impossible burden that Congress never intended and that the court may impose. Now, Congress can do something about that and hopefully can do something about some of these other bad decisions if they come down. And we all have to encourage Congress to do what it can on that front. But the court ultimately has a lot of authority under our Constitution.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it's all too clear that the new majority is prepared to exercise that.
But Elliot, we can't get an infrastructure bill passed through that the overwhelming majority of the country wants. What makes you think we're going to be able to pass another law to protect the disabled?
I think that's a very fair concern. I think that's a very, very fair concern. I think we have seen, unfortunately, in our Congress on that issue, on voting rights, on a number of other issues, the ability of a minority to stop Congress from doing what it needs to do, which emphasizes, I think, the other key thing that people can do. You have to vote. You have to vote as if your life and your rights depend on it, because they do. And that means in elections, you have to consider the Supreme Court as an issue the same way the far right has for 50 years. And you have to vote out members of Congress, be they Republicans or Democrats, that are standing in the way of the key progress. If Joe Biden had another, let's say, three, maybe even one or two truly committed Democratic members of the Senate, we wouldn't be having this conversation, because some of these bills would have passed.
Yeah, we could maybe get something done. No, you're spot on right there. So last line of questioning I've got for you, because, you know, Joe Biden has come out and said that we're going to use the federal government to mandate vaccines for employers that have over 100 people. If you are taking Medicare or Medicaid and you're a hospital system, you have to get it. There are no exemptions. There's no, hey, we'll test you if you wear a mask and all that stuff. My fear and my concern is that this ends up before the Supreme Court and they throw it out. I'm a supporter of mandating vaccines. You have a choice not to do it. Those choices come with consequences. I'm curious if this is something that could be, obviously you're the court expert, if this is something that could end up before them.
It certainly could. There is a long-standing precedent going back, way back to 1917 from the Supreme Court, that says that when it comes to communicable diseases, which can threaten other people, that the states and the government has a right to mandate vaccination, because it's not just you that's affected, it's other people who you infect. I'm very hopeful that the Supreme Court won't overturn that, but with this Supreme Court, who knows?
No, I mean, because I look at the religious extremist bent that I see, and I'm concerned. I'm concerned that I have... let's leave it there. I'm concerned that we don't get something, because maybe we get some kind of crackpot idea of, like, the one woman who said, I'm drenched in the blood of Jesus, so I can't get sick, which is weird on so many levels. But I fear that, or my fear is too out there for right now.
Well, I hope they are, but I wish I could say that they are, because we just don't know. There have only been a very, very few ruling so far from lower court judges, not uniformly one way, but generally have upheld the authority of the government to mandate vaccines when you're dealing with deadly communicable diseases like COVID-19. But we've seen many instances before, like some of the cases we talked about tonight, where the lower courts have done the right common sense thing, and the Supreme Court, with the three Trump justices now added and dominating the court, have gone ahead and reversed it. Yeah. So the short answer is we don't know.
Yeah.
I think we have to continue to do what we've been doing, and the administration deserves credit for actually moving forward in this area. But we cannot relax. We have to continue to push. And I think, although they haven't changed their decisions yet, it's clear, as you pointed out in the beginning, that even these right-wing justices are noticing the severe criticism they're getting. And I think a third thing I'd recommend is that people continue criticizing the court when it does wrong.
There you go. Good stuff. Elliot, I appreciate the time. Thanks for taking time for us.
My pleasure.
Good stuff. Elliot Mintzberg, People for the American Way. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Here at the Rick Smith Show, we don't accept corporate advertising. Never have, never will. We don't stop the show every few minutes to sell you supplements, beet juice, or whatever snake oil the right-wing loonies are pawning. If you like what we do, become a patron by going to patreon.com/Rick Smith Show. That's patreon.com/Rick Smith Show. Give what you can, if you can, and help us fight for the working class majority.
Where common sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.